Okay, thank you, Rekhanovsky. Okay, I don't know how many of you have ever watched the Knesset when they try to pass legislation. You know, if you watch it in, when I grew up, you know, in the States, you can watch anything in America on C-SPAN. No one really watches it. It's usually pretty boring. In Canada, from what I've seen, it's even calmer than the United States. If you've ever tried watching the Knesset, on the other hand, when they legislate or when they're debating anything, it's less calm and tends to be more exciting, but it tends to be a lot of noise. You'll turn it on, and every few weeks, not even every few weeks, every week or two, there'll be someone yelling at someone else, throwing water at somebody else, chaining themselves to the podium. There's a lot of drama going on in the Knesset. And the Knesset, the way the turnover works in terms of the Knesset, the parliament of Israel, is, in theory, it should be 4 years. Every Knesset should last 4 years, and then you'll have new elections. Unless there's a vote of no confidence or the coalition falls apart. If I remember correctly, there have only been two coalitions that have lasted the entire 4 years since the state was founded. It's a very heated, quick-moving government. And the result of that is that Israeli politicians tend not to be known for being experts in, let's say, jurisprudence, in legislative theory. Right? They act, they're pragmatic, they maybe were in the Knesset for a year, 2 years, and then they're gone. It's not, there's no stability. You can have a party which doesn't exist one day, is the biggest party in the Knesset in the next election, then disappears in the election after that. And people will go in and out from politics into the news, and you know, into the media, into sports, and back. It's a very free-flowing, very quick-moving government. And therefore, you tend to have politicians who just, whatever they were voted in for, whatever their party stands for, whether that be on the right, whether it be on the left, whether it be the legalization of marijuana party, which for a while joined with the Rights for Holocaust Survivors party, right? Whatever party it tends to be in Israel, right? It just moves. So everyone was surprised at the beginning of the year when one of the rising stars in Israel, Ayelet Shaked, who is second or third in command, depending on how you look at it, in the Bayit HaYudi party, in the Jewish Home Party, she is second in command to Naftali Bennett, but the Jewish Home Party itself has a sub-faction called Tkuma, so technically she's third on the list, because she's the second on the non-Tkuma, bit complicated, but fine, she's second in command in the Jewish Home Party, who is currently the Sarat HaMishpatim, the justice minister in Israel, gave her opening speech for the year. In her opening speech, she laid out her vision for legislation. She explained not what she was going to do, what she's been doing, but why. What drives her? What shapes her view of the world? What makes her who she is? And you have to understand that she is one of the most controversial figures in Israel. She's known for hardline right-wing positions. She's a firebrand. The world has picked up on this. In The Economist, they had a feature on her last year that she's one of the most important up-and-coming politicians in the world. She's extremely powerful, extremely smart, but extremely controversial because she's very outspoken. And she's, well, in one of the most extreme parties in Israel. But even her detractors celebrated the fact that for once, somebody in Israel told them what they stood for, right? How they legislated, what they thought law was about. So what I want to do is really analyze her thesis. Really, she has more than one thesis. We're going to focus on two. She took this ne'um, this opening address, she turned it into an article along with several other addresses she's given over the years and turned it into an article in a new journal in Israel called Hashiloach, which is a journal devoted to political thought put out by the Tikva Fund. So that's what I want to do. I want to explore her theory, first of all because it's interesting, Second of all, because at least at the moment, she is the justice minister, and therefore what she says is not just theoretical. She's explaining how Israel is changing and will at least change under her tenure as justice minister. So she starts as follows with a quote from Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman, one of the most influential conservative economists of the latter half of the 20th century, writes as follows. He's writing about his visit to Israel, his first visit to Israel, and he writes, two traditions were at work in Israel. An ancient one, going back nearly 2,000 years, of finding ways around governmental restrictions, and a modern one, going back a century, of belief in democratic socialism and central planning. Fortunately for Israel, the first tradition has proved far more potent than the second. Milton Friedman, who was one of the fathers of whatever you want to call it, laissez-faire capitalism, of libertarianism, whatever you want to call it, in the latter half of the 20th century, said he came to Israel and he saw two traditions. Anyone who knows modern Israeli history knows that there was a strong socialist tradition. Many of them had been from Marxist countries, had been influenced by Marxism, by communism, by socialism, all the spectrum of socialism. The kibbutzim were socialist communes. The early politicians in Israel were socialist. And that is a strong tradition in the early part of Israel. Not so much in the last 30 years, but very much at the beginning of the state. But Milton Friedman argued that the central tenets of socialism, the notion that government is responsible to make everything right, that they can fix everything through increased legislation, through taking care of people rather than letting individuals take care of themselves, that tradition was in tension with what he saw as the true tradition of Judaism, which was a tradition that put its value on individual rights, on the ability of the individual to make decisions for himself, for herself, to shape his or her destiny. A tradition which celebrated limited government. That tradition he saw latent in Judaism. And he argued, despite the veneer of socialism in Israel, he believed that what really drove the country was this libertarianism that was just peeking out, emerging from true Jewish sources, and he believed that that was the vitality of Israel, that was what was going to make it succeed. So Ayelet Shaked, in fall 2016, got up in the Knesset and said, there are these two traditions. Milton Friedman already saw it. The early state, and she has facts to back this up and we'll come to them, despite the socialist veneer, really did believe in the fundamentals of libertarianism, of individual freedom, on the belief that government should be limited. But we've lost that in the last few years, and it is my goal as justice minister to bring back the true tradition of Judaism. So what I want to do is explore that thesis. Is she right? Is Judaism at its core, is the Torah in one way or another socialist? Is it libertarian capitalist? Does it believe in government restrictions, government interventions? Does it believe in giving individuals the right and the ability to make decisions with minimal legislation? What does the Torah believe? Is she right? You know what? I was going to save it till the end, but let me bring it right now. Right? If you want the numbers that she puts on it, where did I put it? Oh no, I put it here. I put it in number 6. Just to illustrate her point of the difference in direction that Israel has taken, she notes the following facts. The third Knesset, which was the first Knesset that actually went for 4 years, in a full 4 years, how many laws did they pass? 13. Over 4 years, right? That is a very small number of laws. The 18th Knesset, which was 2009 to 2013, passed 500 laws. Right? 500 laws. The current Knesset, which has already only been around for 2 years, has attempted to pass 1,500 laws. And Shaked, as part of her vision, said that she sifted through each and every one of those laws. It goes to her desk. It can't even come to a vote in the Knesset until it goes past the justice minister. She turned down 1,100 laws, which she thought were so ridiculous they didn't even deserve a reading. And she did this because she believed that this over-obsessive legislation in Israel belied a belief that was antithetical to Judaism. A belief that the government could fix everything, which she does not believe. Yeah.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but in between 1955 and 1959, amongst other eras, this was a deepened socialist
correct
situation in Israel, and they only passed 30 laws. And from 2009 onwards, this is deepened the right-wing...
correct.
Domination of Israel, whether it passes laws or
absolutely
right and center.
Correct. Absolutely correct. And this is the irony.
How does that
So this is the irony, is that Shaked, following Milton Friedman, argues that it was a veneer. That she believes that even though it's true that the early state was avowedly socialist, she thinks the fundamentals of Judaism overpowered that. That even though they were socialist in terms of how they constructed economic policy, right, their fundamental belief was still that in the power of the individual, that government should still stick out of it as much as possible. Right? And that's what she's pointing out, the irony. And she's using this to prove Friedman's point, that even though it was socialist, they only passed 13 laws. And here, at the height of the Netanyahu government, which prides itself in being laissez-faire capitalist, modern, right, liberal libertarian economic policies, you have this inordinate number of laws being passed or being attempted to be passed. And what she's argued is that, right, ironically, right, that spirit of socialism that is carried through. Now, admittedly, because of the way the coalitions are set up, right, a law can be attempted to be passed and not passed, right, by, you know, right now, I mean, the government, I think it's 61-59 in and out of coalition. So, right, you could have the ruling government be, you know, right-wing, and 59 members of Knesset be left-wing, right, and be more of the old socialist tradition. So it's not crazy that many laws could be suggested. Right? But you're right. I mean, there's sort of an irony that as we've moved towards actual financial liberalism, we've moved towards an obsessive amount of legislation. That's really what she's picking up on, right? She is right-wing on pretty much all issues and believes that this shift in legislation towards, you know, government intervention is a problem. She wants to move everything towards that, you know, belief in the individual. But you're right. She's specifically picking on Friedman's point that even though the original government were socialist, it still didn't believe in obsessive legislation. You would have thought it did, but it didn't. Right? And her line about it is what I put after it. Right? Legislation in Israel has reached a dangerous level. The freedom of a citizen in Israel is deeply harmed by this competition between Knesset members from this excessive intervention in their lives. So is she right? Right? Is she right? And this is an important question. It's not just theoretical anymore. And this is what everyone noted. It was refreshing for someone to put out their thesis of how they legislate, especially when that person is responsible for legislation. Right? She is, if not one of the most important people when it comes to legislation, probably the most important because everything goes past her desk. So let's see. So look at number two. If I asked you, what is the number one thing that is pretty much common to all socialist societies, right? Whether they be, you know, violent communist societies, or they just be socialist, or social democrats, or whatever, anything that has anything socialist in it, what tends to be common between all socialist forms of government?
Well,
Yeah, taking care of people, right? That the government's job is to take care of people, right? That you legislate laws to take care of people. You don't leave it to the individual charities. The government does it. So if I just took that as my my test case, so I would very quickly get to a serious problem with her thesis. So look at number two. This is the Rambam, Maimonides, in the Laws of Gift to the Poor. Ninth chapter, he writes as follows. In every city where Jews live, they are obligated to appoint faithful men of renown as trustees of a charitable fund. They should circulate among the people from Friday to Friday and take from each person what is appropriate for him to give and the assessment made upon him. Then they allocate the money. Every Jewish community has to have a central taxation where the charitable fund run by the government collects money, forces people to take to give them money, which they then reallocate to the poor, which is basically the definition of a safety net. Right, that is a socialist safety net. Right now, yes, even the most right wings of countries have some sort of safety net these days, but it's still a socialist component to government. So if I just read that, I would think, no, she's wrong. Right? The Torah has a strong tradition of legislation to protect people, of not leaving it up to people's whims, and not just saying people will give charity when they want, of saying, no, we need government to intervene, we need government to take care of people, and who cares if that limits your freedom a bit? So what? Yeah.
So that's not charity, that's taxation.
Correct. Right, it means it's taxation, but saying that the way charity will be structured is through taxation, through a forced taxation, right, is...
It's no longer voluntary, it's taxation.
Exactly. I mean, that's my point. Right, the fact that Judaism has always had, as the Rambam notes, not just voluntary charity, but has mandatory, if we want to use, charge language, redistribution of wealth... Right, points in the direction there's at least some socialist element to the Torah, because we're not leaving up supporting the poor to charity. We're not leaving to individual autonomy. We're legislating it. But that would be too simplistic and would not at all give the full picture. So, for example, if you look at number three, Rav Shlomo Ephraim Lunshitz, the author of the Kli Yakar, comments on the following law. There's a law called Prika Uti'ina, that if you find somebody whose animal is collapsing under its weight, so you have to help them reload it. But the Talmud says that, let's say you come and you see whatever, you see John and his animal is collapsing, and he sees you coming along and he says, hey, you have a commandment, you have a mitzvah to unload my animal. I'm just going to sit back here in my chair and on the ground. I'm going to have a little picnic and you help my animal. Because look, for me, I'm just helping my animal. For you, you're buying yourself the world to come. Have a good time. The Talmud says you don't have to help him. You only have to help him load his animal or unload his animal if he gets involved too. But if he wants to shunt the responsibility and give it to you, too bad. So let him suffer. Big deal. So the Kli Yakar says that that principle, the notion that if someone can help himself, you don't have to help him if he decides not to help himself, right? That you only help someone who's at least trying to help themselves, he says that rule is in fact not local to Prika Utina, to loading and unloading animals. That is the rule of the Torah. And he writes, this is an answer to some of the poor among our people who cast themselves on the community and refuse to do any work, even if they are able to engage in certain work or in some other endeavor that will bring food to the table. And they complain if they are not given what they are lacking. For God did not command this, but rather, you shall surely unload it with him, and you shall surely help him to lift them up again. For the needy person must do whatever is in his power to do. And if, despite all his efforts, he fails to earn a living, then every man in Israel is obligated to support and strengthen him, and to provide him with whatever he is lacking, and unload even 100 times. Or the Kli Yakar says, don't be deceived. Yes, we have a safety net, but it's a minimalist safety net. If we see somebody who could work and chooses not to, and chooses to rely on the largesse of the state, he doesn't get anything. Tzedakah is a minimalist safety net. It's someone who's trying to work and can't make ends meet and is really falling through the cracks. Yes, for sure, there is a safety net in the Torah. But it's not that we... That's not what we would call in Hebrew lechatchila, right? That's not something we like. It's not something we encourage. It's not something we want people to think is an option to fall back on. It isn't. It's a last resort. If you're trying and struggling and working or trying to find a job and you can't for whatever reason. So then there's tzedakah. And that limitation pushes us in the other direction, right? It doesn't say there's no safety net. And it doesn't say that when there's a safety net, the government doesn't have to ensure that it's there through legislation. But it does say that we don't encourage situations that you have, let's say, in some of these socialist democratic societies in Europe, where the safety net is so good that people don't even want to work, right? The Torah doesn't believe in that. Yeah.
So what about the...
Sorry, what's your name? Just because... David.
So
okay.
What about the religious communities where men... in very religious Jewish communities in Israel and elsewhere, choose not to work, but choose to study Torah, even though they may not be illumined. They just, you know, average Joes who sit in yeshiva all day and expect somebody else to support them. How does that work out with Judaism, with Torah?
And that is... Yeah. It's a good question. A good question in the sense that I don't have a... you know, great defense of it. I'm not sure I'd want to defend it. Meaning, I'll put it this way. The people who oppose it, which included my teachers, right, believed that exactly, right? The Torah does not believe in that. The Torah as a, right, doesn't think that people should be relying on the largesse of the community, if at all possible. The people who will respond and defend it will say, no, the question is, and this is Rav Moshe Feinstein said it. I can't comment on whether Rav Moshe would say it about the current situation, but at least under certain circumstances, he supported people's right or responsibility to be in Kollel by arguing that, yes, the principle is, if possible, somewhat, right, people should go out to work. But post-Holocaust, we needed to rebuild the Torah community, and we needed, therefore, to encourage people to learn full-time to build up the community. And therefore, if people, right, it's actually necessary. It's something the community does need to support. So, without weighing in on who's right. Now, yes, my teachers are not of the community that supported that philosophy, but the principle, I think, is the same. The principle, at the end of the day, is going to be that if it's not necessary, it shouldn't be done. The question, and this is the question where, you know, it sounds like an easy question, but obviously it's not, is what's called necessary, right? If you believe that what's necessary to rebuild the Torah world is to have every eligible male learning full-time, then you think this is necessary and therefore legitimate. If you think that it's not, then not, right? Now, again, it's not my world. It's not my school of thought, right? But I can understand where it's coming from in the sense that it's based on the same principles. It's just understanding necessary in a way that, you know, is much broader. But you're right. That's the fundamental question that you'd have to ask is it called necessary, right? I'm oversimplifying and saying, you know, a reason why it would be necessary. But you're right, right? That is the question to ask, right? You know, and I can't say that my teacher's way is the only way. It's the way that I, you know, follow. But, you know, I can't say that other people's way is not, right, legitimate. There's obviously sources to support both. It's not coming out of thin air. Yes?
Has it really become a political question in Israel where the government cannot remain in power unless it has the ultra-Orthodox support in government, and therefore...
Right, so the way the coalitions work is a bit complicated because, right, as someone once widely pointed out in Israel, everyone in Israel likes to say that everybody else's needs is special interest and their needs are the need of the state, right? But, right, meaning it's true that the kingpins in many of the last, Knessets have been the Haredi parties. But, you know, at some level, that's just one way of looking at it, right? Meaning you could say, well, no, maybe it's, you know, no party in Israel represents even close to the majority of the country, right? Likud, which is the biggest party, which has the prime minister, is 25% of the country, right? It has 30 seats out of 120. So it's a bit more complicated than that to say that it's, you know, that they're asking for their community, but that's basically how the parliament is set up in Israel, right? Most of the parties are small and are quote-unquote special interest groups, but that's just the way it's not like there's two parties of 50, right, and then a bunch of little parties. It's a bunch of small parties that are coming together to create a coalition of 60, each of them representing a different demographic. So, yes, the Haredi parties represent their community, and you know, BYUD represents its community, and Likud represents its community, and Meretz represents its community, and the Arab parties represent their community. So, it's a bit more complicated. I don't like oversimplifying Israeli politics that way.
As a result of that, aren't they already basically violating a major mitzvah of Judaism? Because by their control and imposition of their way of life on the whole population, they are violating the mitzvah that says what is harmful to others, what is harmful to you, do not do unto others. So they are violating this major mitzvah under sanction by a government that wants to remain in power.
But like I said, in Israel, most of the small parties are essentially special interest groups that make up the government, right? For whatever reason, the Israeli government has developed in such a way that it's not made up of huge major ruling parties. It's made up of small ruling parties with a series of special interest parties, for lack of a better term. So you could make that contention about each, you know, subsection within the government, right? And in fact, they do, right? Meaning, yes, people who oppose the Haredi parties argue that they're imposing the support of the yeshivot on them. And they make the claim against BYUD that they're imposing support of the settlements on them. But at the same time, people respond, well, the government, right, part of the deals in the government will also be how much money is funneled to Tel Aviv, how much money is funneled to, you know, the universities, which they don't use. For better or for worse, right, the universities, right, you may think that the Haredi community should go to university. I may even agree. But the fact is that the universities are funded by the government and it's not used by the Haredi sector, right? So they could, right, this is the problem, is in a coalition government like that, everyone can legitimately turn to the other person and say, you know, you're saying universities are for everybody and yeshivot are only for some people. From our vantage point, the world is kept up by the yeshivot, so we're doing this to support, and they do say this, by the way, right, that the spiritual power of Israel comes from the yeshivot. So, you can disagree, but having lived in Israel and voted in Israel, I try to shy away from accusing people of selfishness when the government is constructed by a series of parties who are all fighting for their best interest, because that's just how the government is that's just how it functions, right? Like, it's hard for people in North America to fully understand how the government there works, because we think of two or three ruling parties, right? And it goes from the liberals to the conservatives, and that's it, right? But that's in Israel, most of the parties that exist are special interest groups and are therefore there to fight for themselves, right? If they are lucky enough to be the kingpin, right, then they're lucky, and they're imposing their will. In the last government, it wasn't the Haredi parties, it was Kahlon who was the kingpin, right? Now, Kahlon was fighting for housing, okay, which ostensibly is a need for the whole country, but he was actually the one who had the cards. I don't know. I don't like accusing people of only doing self-interest when everybody's really functioning at some level in self-interest. Even if I disagree with their claims, that's a different thing than saying, you know, you're objectively wrong rather than, you know.
Well, I just want to mention just one thing. I don't want to belabor. Just this week in Israel, a town of about 27,000 people with shuls of every denomination of Judaism, they were very happy with the rabbonim they had, and then the chief rabbi said, you're going to have this fellow as a chief rabbi. You're going to have to pay him 400,000 this,
Okay, I don't want to get into the chief rabbinate. I don't want to get into the chief rabbinate because I really don't want to get into the chief rabbinate for many reasons. Prime among them is that to really understand what's going on in the rabbinate, you have to just you just need to step out of thinking of rabbis in Israel as rabbis in North America. They're not. They're government bureaucrats. They run. The Rabbanut is a government body. It runs certain governmental institutions. So you can agree or disagree, but it's running on a different wavelength. Right? Meaning, even if the, let's say, Kihilah doesn't like the rabbi, if he's good at running the marriage and the kashrut, from the Rabbanut's perspective, he's a good bureaucrat for the job. Now, you may think that the Rabbanut should shift towards caring about community rabbinate, but at the moment, it is a bureaucracy. And it functions as a bureaucracy. Now, that's part of the criticism of it, but it's a reality on the ground. It's a very complicated reality, right? And there are good reasons why people are trying to change it. But anyways, but it's a very complicated reality, and trying to oversimplify it is difficult, right? And even trying to figure out what the right way of going about things is difficult. I'm not someone who endorses everything that's going on in Israeli politics, trust me, but I also try not to jump to conclusions about things because there are legitimately different ways of looking at things in Israel, and it's very hard to put your finger on things. Okay, I'm going to try to. What?
The function of the nature of the coalitions that have existed even since the time of David Ben Gurion.
Yeah, I mean, this is how it's been since 1948.
To allow a government to be able to.
Yeah, and it was the choice of the government to, you know, or it was just the way things developed. There's small parties. There's a reason why there's a push in Israel, and there's a reason there's a push in Israel to eliminate small parties from the government, right? It used to be that you could get into the Knesset if you had enough votes for 2 seats. Now they raised it to 4 seats. But there's a push to make it something like 30 seats or something like that, to basically kill all the small parties because the fundamental nature of a government made up of small parties, it's a bunch of special interest groups fighting against each other. Now, that's one of the reasons. It's one of the things Netanyahu has at least claimed he wants to do eventually, which is, he hasn't yet done it, but he's claimed at least he wants to do that for that reason. The fact that the government has turned into what it is may be a good argument for moving in that direction, but until it moves in that direction, you can't blame people for acting as special interest groups because that's what the government just, you know, is begging you to do. Okay, if you look at number 4, coming back to the sources. So, Rav Lichtenstein, who, my teacher, Zichrono Livracha, writes as follows. He has an article, "The Responsibilities of the Recipients of Charity." Now, in general, Lichtenstein's political views skewed liberal, right? Skewed socialist, if you'll call them that. But despite that, in an article where he was analyzing to what extent does the Torah push for a laissez-faire capitalist worldview, and to what extent a socialist worldview, he notes the following. It says, the degree of recognition, meaning of what the Kli Yakar said, that we push against allowing people to fall back on the safety net, depends in no small measure on the idea of free will. This is why the halachists will be inclined to adopt an ambivalent attitude towards the struggle over welfare budgets across the Western world today, between conservative politicians who are stingy and social workers who are generous. On the one hand, halacha's excessive valuation of chesed and of society's responsibility toward the needy brings him to support the expansion of aid. But on the other hand, the more that this demand is based on the argument that aid must be expanded because psychosocial circumstances fetter the needy and prevent them from joining the workforce, it clashes with the emphasis that Judaism places upon free will. Now, this is coming from someone who politics skewed liberal, skewed socialist. And despite that, he said, on the one hand, Torah believes in taking care of the needy and having a safety net. On the other hand, Torah has such a strong belief in free will, in the value of autonomy, that he's very hesitant, in a practical sense, to encourage increased safety nets because, yeah, we want there to be a safety net, but we don't want to hinder people's autonomy and initiative. That's a problem. And he's noting, if you look at number 5, the Rambam, describing free will. Free will is granted to all men. If one desires to turn himself to the path of good and be righteous, the choice is his. Should he desire to turn to the path of evil and be wicked, the choice is his. This is the intent of the Torah statement. Behold, man has become unique as ourselves, knowing good and evil. The human species became singular in the world, with no other species resembling it in the following quality: that man can, on his own initiative, with his knowledge and thought, know good and evil and do what he desires. So, Rav Aharon notes that there's a lot of truth to what Shaked is saying. That despite the fact that we care about the poor and we want to make sure that the government at least provides a safety net, there is a hesitance in Torah of over-legislation. Now, I should be clear, that doesn't mean we aren't a nation of laws. We very much are. Right? But there's different questions, right? One question is enforcing God's law, right? Now, God's law is law. We call it law, but it's really law plus morality plus theology plus everything, right? So the fact that there's a lot of law doesn't necessarily mean that we believe in over-legislation, meaning God is also telling us morality, right? Even the most laissez-faire capitalist, Adam Smith, says very clearly the only reason the world works the way he thinks it does in The Wealth of Nations, where he endorses capitalism, is because he has a second book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, where he says the only reason we can allow governments to function on pure self-interest is because people don't actually function that way. They're also altruists. But God needs to accomplish both, right? God needs to legislate the bare minimum of justice. He also needs to give us laws about morality because he's God. So the fact that there is a lot of Torah law doesn't mitigate this point in any way, shape, or form. The question is, how much does the Torah need to force us to do things, or how much can it rely on us to use our own free will? And once we have Torah law, how much do the rabbis have to legislate to encourage us to do what's right, and how much can they allow us to do what's right and make mistakes if you know, that's what happens, and I don't know, right, rebuke us or encourage us to do what's right, but not actually legislate it. And Rav Lichtenstein is pointing out is that there is a very strong Jewish tradition of limiting legislation that's going to encourage people to rely on the government, to rely on government intervention rather than realize that the responsibility is in their hands. I think a nice way of really capturing this is what I put in number 7. Rav Yuval Shurlo is a reshiva in Petach Tikva, now in Bat Yam, in Kfar Batya, was asked the following thing. He was asked by the government to help construct halachic principles as they were shaping a policy of how to deal with PGD, of choosing the gender of your child when using IVF and the like. Okay? Now, this is a very heated debate in the Western world. In Canada, you are not allowed to choose the gender of your child. If you do IVF and you choose the gender of your child, the official law on the books is you are subject to up to 10 years in prison and a $500,000 fine. Okay? Because they're afraid of the slippery slope. They're afraid that if we allow people to choose the gender of their child, then they won't just choose it when, let's say, they have 5 boys and they want a girl. They'll choose it because they like boys more than girls, and even if they're having one child, will turn into China. Or if you see that your child has Down syndrome, you would abort that fetus, right? Or whatever it might be. They're afraid that it'll lead to a type of eugenics. And that's basically the concern in the Western world. So they asked Rav Shurlo in Israel, so should we legislate against gender choosing because of the possible slippery slope towards eugenics? Or should we trust people's moral intuitions of when it's legitimate and when it's not? So Rav Shurlo took several principles from halacha and tried to construct a vision of halachic legislation. This is what he said. Torah clearly believes, on the one hand, that sometimes legislation is necessary to protect people from themselves. On the other hand, Chazal have a tendency to avoid legislation if at all possible. How does he know this? So he takes five principles of legislation that Chazal have. One, there's a rule, there's a rabbinic rule that Milsa dilo shchicha lo gazure be'rabanan. If something is uncommon, the danger is uncommon, then the rabbis don't legislate against it. Meaning if the slippery slope, if the result of the slippery slope would be uncommon, we don't legislate against it. Now, he points to that and says, well, what do you see there? That the rabbis think that unless the likelihood of the undesired result is probable, it's not worth legislating. Right? If you believe that legislation against, you know, saving us from ourselves is a good thing, then even if the possibility that we'll harm ourselves or harm society is far off, we'll set up a series of legislation to prevent that eventuality. But he notes that the rabbis say you can't do that. We only make decrees if something is common. Meaning if there's a real pressing need, then we set up legislation to prevent it from prevent something negative from happening. But if it's uncommon, we would rather run the risk of negative things happening once in a while than imposing on the majority of society unnecessary legislation. That's one thing. Second thing he notes is that Chazal have a rule, Ein gozrin gzeira l'gzeira. We don't set up decrees to protect rabbinic law, we only set up decrees to protect biblical law. And another rule, which is, there's one exception. Sometimes we do have second order decrees, which is when the law that might be violated is very, very extreme. For example, chiyuv karet, something that you would get spiritual excision for. Right, laws that if you violated them, you would get spiritual excision. Your soul would be cut off. So then we sometimes have second order decrees, right? That we'll have two orders of decrees. So what if you violate, even if you violate the legislation, you haven't touched the biblical law, right? You have two levels of rabbinic law protecting you from violating the biblical law. He takes these two principles and says that what that shows you is that we take into account how negative the result would be, right? If someone violated biblical law, that's bad. Therefore, we set up a level of rabbinic protection to keep people away from biblical law, right? So, for example, right, we don't allow you to, I don't know, we don't allow you to blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah, on Shabbos, because you might carry the shofar in a public domain, right, which would be a biblical violation. Because when the negative result is really, really bad, I mean, you would violate something that you get the death penalty for, right? So that's really, really bad. So we avoid that at all costs, right? So we set up levels of legislation to protect you from that. But we don't set up levels of multiple levels of legislation to protect you from not, you know, from, we don't set up, you know, 10 levels of legislation to ensure that you light Hanukkah candles. Because Hanukkah candles are rabbinic law. Not a good example, but fine. So he notes that, what does that show you? That the rabbis are telling you, only if the consequences of non-legislation are potentially dire do we bother legislating. But we're willing to run the risk that someone will violate a rabbinic law rather than set up a second order decree. Right? That means that we are not comfortable with multiple levels of legislation, right? With minimal legislation. Legislation to protect the core of our identity, the biblical law, but not legislation to protect legislation, because that's just too much law. And the third thing he notes is that the rabbis built in exceptions for extreme monetary loss. Right? What the rabbis call the makom hefsid lo gazur be'rabanan. When there's a lot of monetary loss, the rabbis don't legislate. Which tells you that when the consequences of legislation would be hard to bear, the rabbi said, even if it's protecting biblical law, we won't bother legislating. Now, I know that's a bit complicated, all those laws, right? But the theory that he presented based on that is that you see that, in his words, the rabbis didn't like setting up laws, and when they did, they took in three things into account. The probability that without legislation, something terrible would happen. The gravity of the potential outcome that we're trying to prevent. Right? And the cost on quality of life to those who have to live under multiple levels of legislation. Right? How bad is it to live under those levels of legislation? Is it worth it to protect the law, right, or the core law, the Torah law, by imposing multiple levels of legislation. And what he said is, when you take all the principles that the rabbis put to limit legislation, what you see is that they actually didn't love legislation. Right? They liked protecting Torah law, but they, right, their basic conception of legislation was, do it when necessary, but not more than necessary. Right? Legislation isn't a good thing in and of itself. It's good if it protects biblical law in a direct fashion. But if it's too removed and the concern is too rare, it's not worth setting up extraneous laws. So if you take that, and you take Lichtenstein's point, what you come up with is that Shaked is sort of right. Right? It's sort of right. Right? I would say on balance, correct. That the Torah believes in a certain basic need to have a safety net to protect people. Basic legislation to protect Torah values. But doesn't encourage over-legislating. Encourages leaving people to their own devices, to protect themselves from harming themselves, from violating Torah law. Right? We set up minimalist legislation because we believe in the power of the individual, in the right to people's autonomy. We have a certain level of trust in people.
That seems all well and good, but it doesn't seem to exist in reality. I mean, you gave the example already of the not blowing the chauffeur on the...
Correct, but like I said, we...
No, and you say, okay, you're not, you can't play a musical instrument on Shabbos because, God forbid, the string breaks. You might be tempted to...
Correct, so we have...
Well, why can't you trust people just to make the right decision?
No, so that's exactly the point. We do at some... Right, we're not totally opposed to any legislation, right? We do think that it's worth protecting Torah law, and we have levels of legislation, but the fact that there are these systematic limitations on legislation tell you that the rabbis had discomfort with over-legislation. Now, you may think that what we have is already over-legislated, but the point is the way the rabbis describe it themselves is that they're trying to avoid legislation, right? And what they see themselves doing is what they saw as minimalist, right? Or relatively minimalist. Not absolutely minimalist, right? I'm not saying that Judaism is far on the libertarian, right, anarchist camp, right? But it's also not quite on the socialist government interventionist camp, right? There's a clear trend where the rabbis self-consciously are limiting legislation. So there was a debate of this recently in Mosaic, which is an online magazine, where Eric Cohn tried to bring some of these ideas together. And he writes as follows. In the 1998 Hayek lecture, Jonathan Sacks, the former chief rabbi of the United Kingdom, took up the challenge of articulating such a Jewish view, meaning of Jewish conservatism. Why, he asked, is there so great an affinity between Jewish ideas and practices and free market ideas and practices? His answer includes such touchstones as biblical respect for the ideas of property rights, biblical appreciation for productive labor, the biblical understanding of man as a creative being, the rabbinic belief that parents must teach their children a useful trade, and the affirmative Jewish attitude towards wealth. In general, Sacks concludes, the Talmudic rabbis favored the free market, a point reinforced by example of how they treated competition among scholars and teachers. An established teacher could not object to a rival setting up competition. The reason they gave for the ruling illustrates the general approach. They said simply, jealousy among scholars increases wisdom. Competition, even the most elevated realm of education, promotes human excellence. This affinity between traditional Judaism and market economics may come as a surprise to those who believe that Judaism is most compatible with some form of socialism. That this is not the case is argued exhaustively in Joseph Isaac Lifshitz's careful study of the biblical and rabbinic corpus, Judaism, Law, and the Free Market. Consider this from the Talmudic tractate Brachot. One who benefits from his own labor is greater than one who fears heaven. And from Psachim, in a teaching of Rabbi Akiva to his son, it is better to make your Sabbath meals ordinary than to become dependent on others. One of the deepest insights arising from the Lifshitz study is that the rabbis understood the obligation to help the poor as a matter of righteousness, not of justice. In taking these, Eric Cohn argues, following Lifshitz, following Rabbi Sacks, in the same direction that Judaism fundamentally values. It values taking care of the poor, but not necessarily legislating it. It's a value, a basic safety net, yes. But beyond that, ironically, we don't have it. Right? That's not legislated, it's morally obligated. It's stuck up, but it's not run by taxation, not by obligatory taxation. And we encourage people not to rely on the safety net if at all possible. But on the other hand, A nine, right, Gill student, pushes back. And he notes as follows. He says, however, as Yuval Levin points out in his response to Cohn, Judaism is consistent with capitalism, but does not necessarily advocate it. Yes, the Torah protects property rights and advocates productive labor, but there is more to capitalism than earning a salary and keeping it. What role, then, can Judaism play in economic ideology? Levin seems to think that Judaism has little to teach the world about capitalism. I suggest that while Judaism may not advocate a specific economic theory that developed a dozen centuries after the close of the Talmud, it can teach the world how to properly implement it. This is a particularly timely task because recent events emphasize how desperately capitalism needs direction. It's one thing to wax passionately about free markets and theory. Getting down to nitty-gritty implementation is quite another. Free markets require regulation to prevent abuse, such as monopolies and corruption. Jews should be morally invested in the implementation of meaningful economic regulation that requires proper behavior of all parties. Capitalism can only survive if it continues to inspire hope. To this, effectively, it must adhere to basic rules of fairness and right and wrong. And Ray Student, I think, captures sort of the compromise position that's probably right, which is, on the one hand, there's the rabbis self-consciously tell you that they oppose over-legislation. On the other hand, as David pointed out before, we have a tremendous amount of legislation when we feel it's necessary. But that combination of the fact that we're uncomfortable with legislation fundamentally, but recognize that often it's necessary on a pragmatic level, right? If we translated that into the modern world, what would that mean? That legislators should hesitate before legislating. But on the other hand, they shouldn't just let, you know, things run amok in the name of individual liberty. They should try to strike a balance between, on the one hand, recognizing that legislation limits individual freedom, on the other hand, recognizing that capitalism, liberalism gone amok doesn't help anybody. And it's that balance which the tradition of Jewish legislation really tries to get at. So, for example, if you look in 10... The Rambam, summarizing Gemara, writes as follows: the court is obligated to appoint police in every city and town to inspect the stores periodically, correct the scales and measures, set the prices. They are permitted to beat any person who possesses an unjust measure or weight or an improper balance according to his capacity, and to fine him as the court sees fit to enforce the matter. Whenever a person raises price and sells at a higher price, he may be beaten and compelled to sell at the ordinary market price. Right? This is the somewhat harsh rabbinic view of I don't know what you call it in Canada, but in the States we call it the SEC, right? The Security and Exchange Commission, right? The people who protect against monopolies, who protect against corruption, theoretically, in the market. I don't know what you call it. I assume there's something equivalent in Canada. So, you know, they clearly do have some level of legislation protection of intervention. But I think if we take it all together, and this, unfortunately, I'll explain what's happening in the last two sources. On the one hand, there is a Jewish tradition, I think, that values free will, autonomy, limits on legislation, trusting people to do what's right, to follow fundamental moral law, Torah law, without piling more and more legislation on them. On the other hand, there's a recognition that we can like that in theory, but in reality, if you don't legislate to an extent, you don't protect people, then the vulnerable get hurt and the cunning, right, oppress them. So rabbinic law, on the one hand, in principle, tries to limit legislation, and in practice, legislates whenever it sees necessary. So how would that translate it into modern world? What that would mean is, on the one hand, the government should recognize a responsibility to legislate when it's necessary to protect the community. On the other hand, it shouldn't legislate for the heck of it. So an example of what Shaked opposed, right? She gave some examples of things she didn't allow even to come to a vote, was obligating the country to buy for every person in the country a stab-proof vest. Right, during the sprees of stabbings. But she said that is an undue, right, the amount of taxation, the amount of imposition. If somebody feels like they're in danger and feels like it's necessary in their life to wear a stab-proof vest, gesunte hate, let them go buy it. But to force the entire country, because in the end of the day, statistically, how many stabbings were there? Right, as as Daniel Kahneman has pointed out, right? Terrorism doesn't function on reality; it functions on the availability heuristic. The fact that we tend to think about vivid images and pretend that they're happening all the time. Right? The availability heuristic, or the availability avalanche. That we see one event and we think it's happening all the time and we jump and we want to act. The government has to be rational and realize that, yes, there were a lot of stabbings, but how, like, it was less than car accidents, right? It was less than people dying of whatever, of, you know, flu complications, right? Is it worth that level of taxation to force everyone to wear a stab-proof vest? Probably not. That's an undue imposition on the country for something that statistically is not actually, right, that common. Right? And therefore, that's what Chaketa is trying to do. She's not saying there's no laws, right? She allowed 400 to at least come to a reading, but she rejected 1,100. So I think that at some level she's got it right. That she sees that there's a tradition developed. Because, now coming back to the original question, how was it that Dafka, how specifically the socialist early state, had so few laws? Yeah, because fundamentally, think about it. Yes, they were socialists, but who were the heroes of the early state? Right, the kibbutznikim who picked them up picked themselves up by the bootstraps, went up, were independent, built up the country, right? They valued independence. When did they set up laws for things they thought were critical? Right, universal health care. Right, things that they thought were basic safety net. But if it wasn't absolutely necessary, they didn't legislate. So ironically, right, they believed in a certain safety net. They did believe in, right, a very socialist economy, right? But there was something about that belief in human autonomy that limited the amount of legislation. Now we've come to the opposite extreme, whereas an economy, it's a flourishing capitalist economy functioning on laissez-faire capitalism. But as a legislative tradition, right, because of all the special interest groups, and that's one of the things she notes, everyone has the things that they think are the most important thing in the world, and they want to legislate it, which is part of what leads to it, right? If each person is a special interest group in the Knesset, then you have your 50 laws that you think are the most important things in the world, which maybe objectively aren't. And what she's pushing towards is recognizing that comes with a cost to freedom. That comes to a cost with the human value, the Jewish value of free will. So I think at some level her thesis is true, and her attempt to roll back legislation, unnecessary legislation, in favor of allowing humans to thrive and make mistakes, but not have the government breathing down their throat, is definitely at least a strong tradition in Judaism, and at least for the next few years, the direction that the government will actually take, because she's in charge. So even if she's not totally right, it's worth understanding the true, that there is a truth to what she's saying, and that her attempt to limit legislation is an expression of at least a very authentic and strong Jewish tradition in that direction. Let me just summarize the last two things, and I'll stick around for questions afterwards, because we've gone a bit long. Unfortunately, we didn't get to her second thesis, which would have been, probably even more heated than the first thesis, which was her pushing for the Jewish state bill, her belief that until now the state has paid token recognition to the Jewish nature of the state in favor of democracy first, and her push that the Jewish state should be Jewish first rather than Jewish as a token, arguing for some far-reaching things, such as the Talmud should be consulted when formulating, formulating Israeli law, such as including in basic laws things about the holidays and Hebrew calendar and Memorial Day, some of which already exist, some of them which are reiterated. But unfortunately, we've reached our time limit. So you can read that. That source is 11 and 12. But that's the other direction that she is taking, is trying to push for a less, what she calls a nominalist Judaism, and more for a substantive Jewish voice and feel in the actual legislation. Right, once we actually get to legislation, right? First, she opposes legislation. But when you do legislate, she wants it to be Jewish first and then democratic, rather than democratic and then Jewish. Though a little bit more complicated, because she thinks they're not at odds, but I think that's going to have to be a shear for another time.